I'm seeing radical feminists use exactly the same rhetorical strategies to try and avoid facing up to the truth as was used against them.
The tension between proponents of feminism and proponents of diversity. Mm-hmm. Now, this has been a thing for some time.
I mean, my sense is that progressives are panicked in all sorts of ways, but particularly on this. And I feel like when you're playing these language games, it's probably because actually we've strayed quite far from reality. The big question is whether modernity survives.
Yeah.
I'm rooting for modernity in the end. Like, for all of the problems with
I like the internet and I really like my washing machines.
And so, I really like C-sections and antibiotics. Okay, so I'm very much rooting for modernity. But even if modernity doesn't survive...
Welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington. And today I'm joined by Louise Perry, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, and host of the fantastic podcast Maiden Mother Matriarch. Welcome, Louise.
Hello.
Louise, we've known each other for a little while, and in the course of our conversations we've talked a lot about how we came to form the views that we now have. Now you've talked previously in public about your education at SOAS, which is a notoriously progressive, I think we might say, woke university.
Yes.
In, was it cultural anthropology? Or something along those lines.
I think social anthropology.
And how you cut your teeth professionally as a campaigner on violence against women. Mm-hmm. So I think my first question to you is, what radicalised you? What brought you from there to your more provocative positions and your current stance on politics, on violence against women, and on the world as it actually is?
Well, SOAS certainly helped a lot. I think so. SOAS is actually a fascinating institution, which deserves to be better known. Mm. So it was.
Explain what does SOAS stand for?
I shall. So it's, well, nowadays it doesn't stand for anything.
It just stands
for SOAS because, okay, so the original name of the university is the School of Oriental and African Studies. And it's a small college of the University of London. And I think it was founded in about 1905, something like that. And it's now just called SOAS because they found the Oriental bit too problematic. And so they just rechristened the university. It's very small. It exclusively teaches Asian and African culture related subjects, including law and history and whatever. So I did social anthropology. A really interesting thing about SOAS is it was founded as a finishing school for colonial officers, particularly as a language school for people who were going to go out and serve in these parts of the world, which is why, of course, it's focused on Asia and Africa and not, say, South America, because it's the British Empire that it was concerned with. And I assume that there was a period where there was a kind of ideological changing of the guard, where you had the old blokes who was still teaching there from the colonial days.
Who'd known Lawrence of Arabia personally.
Exactly. And then you had the new people coming in. And there must have been a period of some decades where there was friction.
Thumps and squeaks off stage.
Yes, I would love someone to write about this. When I was there, it was very woke. And actually, I'm really pleased that I went to SOAS for multiple reasons. One, I learned all sorts of really interesting things. I did loads of courses that I would never have been able to do anywhere else. I did a whole year on Japan, for instance, you know, all these kinds of exposure to subjects, which I think a more normal anthropology degree would have been more focused on historical anthropology and less focused on contemporary stuff. So anyway, that was all good. It was also very useful because I had an absolutely intense introduction to, like, progressive ideology, not just in terms of the student body, but also in terms of what we were asked to read. And this was at the period, for instance, when transgenderism was ascendant, but not yet mainstream. And we were taught it like it was fact, just straightforward. There was absolutely no counter-narrative offered at all. This is fact. But it was at a time where it was quite cutting edge and quite exciting. And most people, I think, exposed to it in that context thought that it was cool.
Did you think it was...
And actually, it was a very useful experience for me in being... I think if I hadn't been exposed to the most extreme manifestation of this ideology, it would have taken me longer to become critical of it. As it was, I thought, no, this is crazy. And I kept that to myself. And I actually became friends with Julie Bindle when I was an undergraduate because she was disinvited from speaking, I think, at SOAS or at the University of London. And I thought this was wrong. And I emailed her and just said, as a student, I just want to let you know that I think it was bad that you were turned away. And she very kindly responded saying, how nice, would you like to get a coffee? And I did. And this is a long time ago now, so I've known Julie ever since. So I was like a baby TERF at a time where that really was a fringe thing to be. It was really the only person who was publicly TERFy at that point was Julie.
So this was back in the late aughts?
No, not as early as that. This would have been like 2013.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just as the Great Awakening was beginning to
gather. So I was right there in the thick of it. And you know the Napoleon line about what was happening in the world when a man was 20? That's what was happening in the world when I was 20. Yep. And I was really in the middle of it. And so I suppose progressivism loomed large in my life. And honestly, I don't think I'm ever going to quite be able to shake that. Even as I think probably what is happening now is actually progressivism is really waning in its influence. And the big ideological fissures of our time aren't quite at that, aren't necessarily there anymore. There are other fissures, I'm sure we'll get onto. But I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to shake off the feeling that I've got progressives looking over my shoulder waiting to counsel me. Yeah, because that was my experience as a young woman.
Yeah, for me, it was that atmosphere for me was the end of history, which I'm sure for similar reasons I'll never shake.
Interesting, yeah.
But that's a half a generation going away.
It's like fixing your music taste when you're about 15.
Did that happen to me? I have terrible taste in music, so I've no idea. So then, I mean, you fast forward another decade-ish, and you and I converged.
COVID time.
Roughly around circa COVID, yeah.
Yeah.
Where this sort of interesting convergence happened, where the sort of undercurrents of TERFism, which had been bubbling for the whole of the 2010s, you know, began to crystallise into people thinking and wanting to articulate more clearly that this doesn't make sense. And actually, you know, wanting to make those arguments and make those cases more extensively. And so that was all really quite a kind of ferment. And your book came out, I think, about a year ahead of mine and did really well. And there you made the case that the sexual revolution in its entirety had been net negative for women. And you brought a whole panoply of evidence to this. And the book really made an impact. And then you and I got to know each other, I think, around that point, because it turned out we had come to, you know, from really quite different backgrounds and different perspectives and generations, to this conclusion that no, in fact, liberal feminism has overreached, and this is doing nobody any favors, and it's not just the transgenderism thing. There's a whole panoply of other things as well. So you know, rather than re-rehearsing those arguments, which I think are sort of fairly well kind of percolated out into the discourse now, I thought it might be fun now since I've actually got some time with you to say, you know, that's how it started. At least in terms of our mutual acquaintance and collaboration. How's it going? What do you think? So we've had a good chunk of time for, you know, what's your sense of how things have developed in the period since? Has there been, you know, where are the backlashes coming from? Where have the winds been? What's the state of play in whatever you want to call our little wave of feminism?
I think the first time we probably ever spoke was on Unheard Lockdown TV.
Was that it?
I think so. Would have been early COVID.
Yeah.
And
was that the one where my cat came, or the one where my toddler came and climbed into my lap?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, and it was all quite.
We were all very new to it.
We were a bit. And I think that it's important to remember that a lot of our thinking at the time was really converging around post-liberalism.
That's right.
As an intellectual movement. And various publications, including Unheard, which we were both writing for at the time. And so in a way, I guess the broader question relates to that as well. Like how has, because reactionary feminism is a facet of a larger ideological question. And I'm not sure how I feel about post-liberalism now, honestly.
I remember having a conversation with someone at Unheard about a few months into COVID, who said, we don't say post-liberalism anymore.
Right.
I think the phrase was, you know, isn't everything post-liberal now?
Yeah.
And I remember that really stuck in my mind because it was a prescient assessment of something which I realised the moment he said that to me, I realised it was true.
Yeah.
And that actually COVID was the post-liberal moment. And it turned out that post-liberalism doesn't mean what the Red Tories and the Blue Labours thought it meant. Yeah. In fact, it meant something much, much colder, much more technological, and not really congenial to any of the sort of social conservatism with a side order of Catholic social teaching.
Yeah.
Kind of sensibilities.
What we're all hoping for.
That we're all hoping for.
Yeah.
I remember the phrase that really kind of resonated most pervasively in my mind during that whole COVID era was this is the wrong post-liberalism and I want to see the manager.
Yeah. Which is of course true on the left as well.
It is. Yeah. The
left, if anything, might have abandoned liberalism much more vehemently. You think of someone like Mandani or any of these figures who really embody the zeitgeisty left. Mm-hmm. They're not liberals.
No.
I mean, maybe in the very loosest sense of the term, but their deepest commitments are not to liberal ideas.
No.
And that's also true on the right, you know, increasingly. There are still classical liberals flying the flag. And I, in my heart of hearts, I want them to prevail. I really do. I just feel quite sceptical about their capacity to prevail. I'm not sure if... I feel as if liberalism is not the human default by any means. And therefore...
No, I think the gloomy conclusion which I'm coming to is that it was a byproduct of the print era.
Yeah.
And it only works in a print media environment.
Interesting.
Because there's a sweet spot between the broadcasting of information and the propagation of literacy, which creates the liberal, information-consuming, rational, civil discourse-y subject.
Yeah.
But then there's the sweet spot where information doesn't proliferate so far in such brain-rotting formats as to exhaust that and reverse it into this kind of retarded goldfish discourse, which is what we have now, where nobody can remember what the moral panic was 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And these sort of deranged mass emotional events seem to come sort of once or twice a week.
Mm.
To the point, I mean, I found myself recently, I've become more and more actually conscious in responding to those sorts of emotional panics about needing to be intentional in not allowing them to consume you.
Mm.
Because partly because if you do it for a living, or if you're engaged in that and you're sort of, people expect you to have an opinion on whatever the latest moral panic is, it sort of eats your soul after a while, I think. And I mean that in quite a literal way.
Yeah.
About as literally as it's possible to. I feel sort of polluted.
Yeah.
Unless I'm being quite deliberate about maintaining some distance from that ecosystem.
Yeah.
But that was all. And I think perhaps what was so reality warping about COVID was that was the point where that way of existing socially hit critical mass. You know, I mean, being very online had been a thing before then, but it wasn't. But COVID just forced everybody into it, including people who are not disposed, who are not naturally inclined towards that.
Mm.
It was sort of the moment of mass literacy, but for the internet, and everything which has just come to seem weird in politics since then has sort of been downstream of that. And I feel like we haven't really got a grip on what just happened yet at all. So when we say liberal, I mean, we could say the fourth wave stuff, where it's sort of woke and radically sort of post-embodiment.
Yes, right. Okay. So the thing that we both took aim at in our books, which is this idea of there being no meaningful physical or psychological differences between the sexes, that women and men are just interchangeable widgets.
Right. And actually, you could make the case that emerged in the 2010s partly as a byproduct of the fact that the left became very online first. that they were actually early adopters of all of that entire, of that that mode of consciousness and that mode of thinking about what a person is. And I mean, if you'd become of age, your formative socio-cultural experience was mediated through Tumblr. I think it's sort of legitimate to draw the conclusion that in fact men and women are interchangeable, and in fact, you know, we're all just sort of floating
in
consciousness.
Digital space,
in digital space. And that therefore it's legitimate to reskin your meat avatar in the same way as you reskin your digital one.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, people are just transposing that metaphor quite sort of naturally into the real world, and are then angry and aggrieved and sort of genuinely bewildered when people are like, no, you actually you can't do that, it doesn't work.
The laws of
physics and biology and so on just don't really work like that.
So
that's the thing that you and I were both responding to, sort of very very online early adopter kind of body radicalism.
And of course that does still persist. I mean, it may have become, sections of it have become increasingly extreme and deranged.
And it's also lower status now.
That's what I was going to say, which is actually sort of unexpected, because you'd think as everyone becomes more and more online, that mode of thinking about men and women would become more common. And actually,
it's not working like that at all.
No, in the last few years, I think. I mean, there are bits now where I look back at my book and think that's a bit out of date.
Being able to spend time offline is actually a flex now, in the same way as being able to have loads of kids is a flex.
Because of course we were both writing, or maybe you a bit less so because a year later, but about before kind of the trad wife online phenomenon had really built up a head of steam, which was of course in a way doing, I mean, I think we both have critiques of the whole trad wife idea, right? But it was reacting against the same thing that we were reacting against, just in a different medium. And yes, I think that actually the reaction against men and women as interchangeable widgets has come very aggressively in the last few years. And so if I were writing the book now, I think it would have to be quite a different book. But this is the nature of online culture. It moves very quickly.
That's right. When you write a book, you sort of have to do it. You have to do it at warp speed.
With
an eye on the middle distance. And sort of take a punt on.
It's one of the challenges of writing books.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And one of the reasons why people increasingly intellectuals do podcasts instead of books. It's true, though.
I'm going down with the long form ship. For better or worse, I've lashed myself to the mast and I'm going down with the ship.
It's good for you as a writer. It really is. I find writing books hard. I think you find it easier than I do writing long.
Well, I mean, I'm only on the second, and I found this one. I found it really hard to claw out the chunks of time that you need, and that's actually the thing which I think is definitely the hardest. Is just making the space, because if you have a day here and a day there and a day there and a day there with other stuff in between. Somebody put it really nicely. They said there are startup costs. Like, you need X number of hours to recall all of the moving parts that you need to be conjuring with to mind. And once you've got all the moving parts front of mind, then you can work really quite quickly. I mean, I think I banged out 3 chapters in 3 weeks once I had all the pieces. But in the previous 3 months, I'd had constant interruptions to the point where it hadn't been possible to do that.
So there's a
mode of consciousness. It's not even so much that writing books is difficult. It's that there's a mode of consciousness which is increasingly inaccessible because life is so full of interruptions. And perhaps actually this speaks to what we were saying about life offline being a flex, because at the point where you realise that long form thinking is a luxury good, is a little bit like realising when you get into the airport that silence is a luxury. Silence is a luxury good, and also, you know, having the time and resort the non economic resources available to be able to raise joyfully multiple children is a luxury good. We've reached this, in a sense, I think we've passed peak growth, and the global financial crash was it. We're into degrowth now. I mean, that's a whole nother doomer conversation we can get onto in a minute. But I think, you know, in this weird sort of post-economic place we're in, where nothing really works the way it's supposed to anymore, you know, actually all of the goods which are really valuable are increasingly obviously positional ones. You know, everything which is subject to Baumol's cost disease is now rocketing in value, and everything else is just cheapening to the point of being meaningless.
I also think that the ability to resist the online temptations
Yes.
is increasingly the way of demarcating your own. Well, so put it differently, people who can resist, who have the personality or psychological traits necessary to resist the worst of the online world, are in a uniquely advantageous position.
That's right.
And the
The all the
traits.
alpha is being able to unplug from the Skinner machine.
Yeah. And I mean, it applies to
And it's
other things as
brutal. It's the
well.
most brutal scissor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you know, in the way that weed is a scissor, but actually it's not that hard to avoid being a stoner.
Yeah.
Really, it's not that hard.
Yeah.
And you know, there are but avoiding being a an iPhone stoner isn't
Yeah.
so many orders of magnitude harder.
Yeah, because typically you do have to use these
Yeah,
devices, so you
yeah,
can't
yeah.
go cold
And you
turkey.
and when you pick it up, the moment you pick it up, it's like ooh. And
Yeah.
then half an hour, you've just lost.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
And also, you've let the vampire in, because you're immediately sucked into whatever this week's emotional panic is,
Yeah.
whatever this 10 minutes is emotional panic is, and that's consumed your entire inner life
Yeah.
to the point where it becomes increasingly difficult to think,
Yeah.
or you know, to compose your own thoughts.
We're used to people. It's already the case that one's ability to resist other areas of limbic capitalism has been a status marker for a while.
Yes.
So we're filming in the city of London, and I was walking around at rush hour this morning and noticing that everyone is slim.
Yep.
Everyone is well groomed. Everyone is clearly going to the gym. This is a key way in which you can identify the fact that people are rich because they work from
Yeah.
here.
And the moment they realized that Ozempic and the other GLP drugs were so effective, they immediately hiked the price, so it goes back to being a class signal again.
Right, but it's still the case that Ozempic can make you skinny fat, but it can't make you look buff,
Yeah.
which is
That's true.
like every man who works in the city around here is also going to the very many fancy gyms that you walk past. It's
Yeah.
part of the culture.
It's
And it's because,
table stakes.
yeah, and it's a way of indicating your own self-control. That, I think, is increasingly true also of your digital self-control, but physically manifesting it is in a way that can display your status is maybe more nascent. I'm not sure how you would indicate that.
I know. I mean, you and I have talked before about digital modesty, haven't
Yeah.
we? And there's a sense in which you sort of if when you see somebody doing something digitally immodest, you know it when you see it. It's sort of difficult to it's d difficult to define precisely, but you know
Yeah.
when somebody's oversharing, when somebody's posting photos of themselves that you just think, don't do that, or you're going to regret that later. You might not regret it now, and you're going to and I can see that you see the likes coming in, and you see the dopamine that they're obviously enjoying, and then you think
Yeah.
you're probably going to regret this later,
Yeah.
even if you don't realize for a number of years why you're going to regret it.
So two conjectures about why fourth wave feminism might have peaked a bit. One is that people just got bored and it was no longer voguish and they moved on to different things. Primarily, they moved on to race.
Yep.
Because really, post 2020, that became the
Yep.
thing.
Yep.
And Jezebel feminism was just sort of
Yep. Yep. Yep.
abandoned.
Yep.
And the women now who probably previously would have been going on like slut walks or something 10 years ago are now trailing ice around. Okay, so to
Right.
some extent, it might just be that that group of activists have pivoted their attention. It's also possible that actually the idea of men and women as interchangeable widgets has become less attractive in an era when people are so excessively online to the extent that it makes them sick. And I think maybe there's a longing for embodiment, maybe, among the sort of people who engage in this kind of political discourse. Those are both just hypotheses. They might both be right as well.
So much for fourth wave, the Jezebel girls.
Yeah.
What about the rest of the gender discourse? I'm thinking particularly of the backlash, the noises that are now coming from inside the right wing house. Which is a whole other, you know, quite sensitive and quite volatile territory.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to put it bluntly, I feel the urge to punch right these days much more than I used to.
It's because we're centrists. We've
The
always said
original
this.
squashy
We've always insisted to each other
centrist.
that we're
It's
centrists, but we
true,
actually
but we
are.
actually are.
Yeah. It's just that people on the left tend not to realize that because they don't know how far the right goes.
That's
And
right.
they don't
They have no idea
understand.
what right wing actually looks like,
Yes. And they
and
also don't understand
they
there's
have no
this
theory of
outward
mind for us. Yeah.
homogeneity bias where they don't see that the right is divided. So, yes, we're in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, we're I suppose I'm thinking about phenomena, you know, such as repeal the 19th, with that meme in the United States. And there's a, I'm not gonna point or name or, but there's a theme that I see sloshing around, you know, the sort of internet anons, which seem it's a sort of fantasy, I suppose, that everything would be all right again across every area you care to name, if only we could just push women out of public life.
Yeah,
and it seems to be sincerely believed, firstly, that men have been systematically bullied, excluded, marginalised, and told that they're rubbish in every possible way, which is, you know, at least to a substantial extent true in some ways.
Yeah,
like that's a reality. Yeah. You know, however, I wonder if the solution doesn't rather put the cart before the horse. I don't know what I mean. What do you make of that discourse?
Well, one of the questions it begs is why men have allowed that to happen.
You would know. I asked that on Twitter once, and you would not. I mean, people went bananas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One explanation which is plausible is that men in positions of authority allowed this to happen because they either wanted to get laid or just wanted to be chivalrous, that they did it to please women, not appreciating that if they let so many women into positions of authority, that it would change the culture. And so the men were just sort of not thinking with their brains, kind of.
That's one hypothesis. But also I feel like one of the counterfactuals which doesn't get reckoned with often enough is that actually a lot of the managerial phenomena, which are routinely pointed at as evidence of feminization, began to emerge and to be critiqued. I mean, you know, James Burnham was critiquing managerialism a long time ago, shortly after the Second World War. There were not very many women in public life just after the Second World War.
Yeah.
I mean, women had only been enfranchised at that point for about two decades in the United Kingdom, at least. So the idea that, for example, the culture of academia was already rampantly sort of overrun by HR ladies is just for the birds. It's just not true.
Yeah.
And yet here is this well worked out critique of, you know, technocracy and managerialism, and a lot of those sort of social architectures of the kind whose existence is now blamed on the conflict styles and cultural preferences of women. And I wonder if blaming it on women isn't sort of putting the cart before the horse somewhat, in the sense that, you know, having embraced a sort of managerialist mode of existence, at least for information workers, you know, sort of upper echelon office job people, it wasn't at least as much that work just became much more congenial for women and a much more sort of livable place, you know. And then of course you could argue that subsequently, you know, recursive feedback loops exist which bring us out in a place where actually some of the more direct critiques of quote unquote feminization are true, but I'm not sure that it started there.
I mean, the argument that you've made, which I think is so beautifully true, which is that Twitter in particular, but online discourse in general, makes everyone behave in a feminine way because it forecloses the possibility of violence.
Yeah.
So it may be as that modernity feminizes everybody.
Yes.
And that is what gives the appearance of a feminized.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, I'd never really thought about it like that before. But the sort of the crude characterization of social media and sort of Twitter in particular, but social media in general, as incentivizing endless talking and foreclosing the possibility of violence.
Yeah.
You know, shoves all the interactions which are mediated through that environment into a much more feminine coded mode. But I mean, you could say that, you know, incentivizing endless talk and foreclosing physical violence is really just the characteristic of information type office jobs, full stop.
And also of the
information
total
societies.
States,
yes.
Using Orrin McIntyre's term, but the, like, police forces have the effect of feminizing men, for instance, because they take away one task which is traditionally falls on men.
So you think the state monopoly on violence is just feminizing,
yeah,
as such?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that's how it is. I think that it forces people to, it certainly forces people to be aggressive to one another in a different way. And that's part of what probably, and I mean, also there's wider changes to the economy which have left a portion of men somewhat obsolete economically, which is just no one designed it that way. But it turns out that it's easier to mechanize heating your home and offshoring manufacturing and things like that than it is to mechanize care work. We don't have care robots. Like, not really. That's just never, that hasn't worked. So there's this whole...
People keep trying, but no, obviously it doesn't work.
Yeah, so pink collar work remains as dominant as it ever was, whereas blue collar work hasn't. And that's just a quirk of robotics, which no one designed. But that is part of what's contributing to the feeling of male disposability. So Helen Andrews' thesis on feminization of public life, I don't really disagree with her.
I mean, her thesis is actually very, her argument is actually very modest.
Yeah.
Like, by comparison with some of the people who've picked it up and run with it.
Yes.
You know, because they're always...
You could say the same of our arguments.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. You know, somebody makes a modest and carefully thought through and well-evidenced argument,
yeah,
and then the nutters in the comments will do whatever they do.
Yeah.
And Helen's argument is really only that it would be better to take the thumb off the scales.
Yeah.
I think that really is the entirety of her
that's
call
the only,
to action.
That's her only policy output,
which
yes, is to say that we should stop doing affirmative action for women.
I mean, I think I support that.
Yes.
I think taking the thumb off the scales. I suppose you can have a secondary argument if you want about whether it's possible to take, or whether, you know, it's just a question of whose thumb.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a very post-liberal
argument
in itself, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the expansive sense of post-liberal. That it just invites, you know, there is no neutral.
Yeah.
In fact, it's just a question of whose thumb is on the scales.
There are, of course, more ambitious things that one could do to try and return to a previous status quo, like disenfranchising women. I mean, that's the big thing that always gets mooted.
But you see, I honestly don't think it would work.
No.
And the reason I don't think it would work is that if you go back and you look at the history of the enfranchisement of women, at least in the United Kingdom, I'm not so familiar with the history of the vote, women's vote in other countries. But in England, the argument against the enfranchisement of women, as it was advanced by, I mean, there were obviously misogynists who were just, oh no, we mustn't let women vote because they're silly creatures. But the female argument against the enfranchisement of women, and there was one, you know, it was a large and well organized and well resourced campaign, was that women already have enough power because they run civil society. I mean, that's a reductive paraphrase of it, but the argument was that, one, women are not going to go and join the army and die for the country, so therefore they shouldn't be involved in decisions about military or imperial matters, and two, women already have political power because they run all the civil society organisations. You know, they're basically the circulatory system for the church, for local social groups, and so on. And a lot of the anti-suffragists were very pro women being able to stand in local elections for the same reason. So it was a coherent argument, and it wasn't the one that subsequent history has said it was.
Mm.
But all of their arguments were basically abolished or rendered obsolete by a political change, which came at the end of the First World War, and really over the period of the two World Wars in England, where all of those organs of social reform and social disciplining and all of the social infrastructural stuff, which had been the province of the church ladies in the 19th and early 20th century, were nationalised in the form of the welfare state. And at that point, it simply didn't make sense to leave women disenfranchised when they were still needed to run all of those systems that they'd previously run on a voluntary basis. You know, I mean, anti-suffragist women who'd been prominent, I forget the names, but there were women who were prominent in the anti-suffrage campaign, who then, when their social reform organisations were nationalised, transitioned seamlessly into local government. And so the reason the argument for against women's suffrage went away was because they nationalised all of the things that women had previously been doing.
Mm.
And I suppose if you bring that argument up to the present day and you think, well, we still have all of those infrastructures, they're all still nationalised, they're all still basically run by the modern day equivalent of church ladies.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances, you could remove the vote from women, but what difference do you think that would make to the amount of social and cultural power those women actually have? All the enfranchisement of women really did was acknowledge the reality of the political power of a certain subset of influential middle class women.
And there's a tendency, I think, to exaggerate how big, uh, how how differently men and women actually vote.
That's right.
Like, if you look at how, I mean, the thing the online right gets so energized about is the difference between, it's really white men and white women in America and how they mm-hmm. vote. And it's like, you look at the actual, you know, it's like this is this tiny little area which is considered to be so vexatious. Like, white women and white men vote very similarly. Like, race has a much bigger impact on voting than does sex. Mm-hmm. But also on all sorts of issues, like, immigration would be a very vexing one. So the idea you'll commonly hear is that women just absolutely love open borders. Women do not love open borders. You look at polling on what normal women think, and they are roughly in line with men in that they hate open borders. Again, it's like,
you
know,
it depends very much on which women you ask.
Well, exactly.
Where in the country you
I
are.
Think it probably is the case that at the sort of far tail, the far left tail politically, you get more women who are really agitating on some of these questions, including on open borders. You have more prominent activists who skew female, and on the right, prominent activists probably skew male. I think that's true. But those people aren't going to go away if you disenfranchise them.
No, exactly. What difference is it going to make?
Yeah.
while we're on the subject of women and feminism, and this actually segues me beautifully to the next topic I wanted to look at in our review of RxFem. Since we all started doing this, which is the really interesting and challenging tension, which really feels more urgent and present by the day, between campaigners for women's rights and against violence perpetrated against women, and or the tension between proponents of feminism and proponents of diversity. Mm-hmm. Now, this has been a thing for some time. I mean, I remember there were enormous bun fights on Mumsnet back in the early 2010s. I forget exactly which year it was when the Cologne New Year's Eve sex attacks happened.
Oh, good question.
It was a long time ago. It was either the late aughts or the early tens.
Yeah.
And it was a very shocking incident, or at least it was very shocking at the time. It's sort of wearily routine in Britain today, yeah. It feels. But at that time, there had recently been a very large influx of people from Syria and the Middle East into the country. Mm-hmm. And on one New Year's Eve, a number of women had experienced this very shocking moment of being surrounded by men who groped and harassed them, and, you know, left them very frightened and feeling as though, you know, so something really grave was about to happen to them. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of group-based sex attack of a kind which had hitherto, I think, been pretty much completely unknown in Western Europe. And I believe it has a name in...
I believe it has a name too, but I forget.
Taharush Gamaya, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it.
It's a particular mode within
the Middle
East.
Yeah, it's a mode of... Yeah, where it was a sort of swarming upon and sexually attacking a lone, isolated woman who can't defend herself.
Yeah.
This is a thing. It's
famously happened to that American journalist.
That's right. That's right. And this is there's actually a name for it in some Middle Eastern cultures.
Yeah.
But it was very shocking. And I remember the bun fight on Mumsnet about how women should respond to that. You know, this is obviously a community of women who take seriously. I mean, the feminism boards of Mumsnet are famously, you know, the incubator, the pipeline into gender critical feminism, and have been for a long time.
Those ladies are pretty scary too.
Yeah, I mean, these are.
I don't participate in these message boards.
don't mess with the mums of Middle England. Absolutely, and they know them, rightly so. And also, what's interesting about Mumsnet and the mums of Middle England is that they're very centrist. They're genuinely not ideological. Their concerns are, you know, can I raise my children safely? You know, cost of living. You know. It's just sort of normal person stuff, you know, and rightly so. This is the sort of thing you feel like we ought to be free to be concerned about.
Mm.
Yeah, they're not party political, really. But there was this enormous quarrel fight about the New Year's Eve sex attacks in Cologne. And since then, that theme has recurred on an ever more insistent basis. You know, how do we pass the question of women's safety in relation to the very different norms concerning, you know, sexual behaviour around women, which are common in other countries, and as these collide with the greater mobility of people and the, you know, the influx into Western countries of people from these very different cultures? And I mean, you know, it's something that I mean, you've posted and written about the grooming gangs on a few occasions recently, and it's something which I found myself, especially as my daughter gets older, increasingly thinking about.
Yeah.
And as we increase it with mounting horror. I mean, how do we move forward with these questions?
You notice it's an increasingly pertinent division among TERFs.
It is.
It has been for a little while, but I think that's becoming more and more insistent because, and in many ways, actually, where we're at right now with the arguments among women on this, it reminds me so much of about 2013. In terms of the transgenderism.
Say more.
In that there are you still have to tread very carefully. You could get in a lot of trouble for saying the wrong thing. There are certain figures who get hung out to dry, as you know, who get Judy Bindled. But you know, Posy Parker would be the person really who's been Judy Bindled on this question within feminist
circles.
And
doesn't care.
No.
Really doesn't care.
Is admirably unconcerned. And it also, I think, depends on some claims about human nature, which are just false, which is obviously false.
Yeah.
And demands all sorts of, like, I think that the I'm straying into controversial waters here, but this is a debate that is constantly being had, and I think is important. The debate that you have over civic nationalism often rests on the versus ethnic nationalism often rests on the same premises as the debate over what defines a woman. So that people will say, so talking about an ethnic group, okay, which is more slippery than a sex class, right? The distinctions between men and women are, you would think, very clear. And yet we did have, there was a whole thing there where people didn't accept this. But you'd have the same arguments around, oh, but what about this edge case? Oh, but what about someone who's had surgery? Oh, but what about someone, you know, like what even is a woman? Is it someone who has ovaries? Is it someone, but I don't have ovaries because I had them removed. You have this like insane level of popular philosophizing about what exactly defines a woman. You get exactly the same thing over ethnicity. Now you say, oh, but you know, isn't everyone related to everyone? Oh, but what about the Danes? Oh, but what about the, you know, the Celt, whatever? Like, yes, there are fuzzy edges, of course there are fuzzy edges, but these things exist.
I mean, the answer I tend to give to people is like, okay, sure, but if you put me and my daughter if you plonked us down on a beach in, say, southern Italy, and you asked any 5-year-old Italian kid on that beach to point out the two English, yeah, the English mother and her daughter, all of them would point at us.
And it wouldn't be because you were sipping tea.
No, and it wouldn't be.
Although you probably would be.
It wouldn't be because we were sipping tea and playing croquet. No.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is exactly the same mode of like insane biological denialism. And look, you don't have to say, you can still hold like certainly a soft civic nationalist position, absolutely, and say, well, British is a legal category and people can be incorporated into it in various ways. But that doesn't mean that the ethnic group doesn't exist. And that's what you're constantly hearing. Like to the point where there isn't actually a word that you're allowed to use to describe people indigenous to a particular European country. In exactly the same way that for so long you weren't allowed to, like what you're allowed to say cis women and trans men. Or maybe you're allowed to say people assigned female at birth. But the only things you were allowed to say within
this
discourse
were... Have you ever been tempted to describe yourself as cis English?
I did write some while ago that maybe that's the term that we should use, cis English or cis British or whatever. Because that's to me what recalls so much that particular period of political conflict is this funniness over language, and that people will be jumped on for slipping up slightly. And I feel like when you're playing these language games, it's probably because actually we've strayed quite far from reality.
But it also strikes me that it's possible to have some of these conversations about women's safety and border management without needing to litigate in any great detail the ontology of
yes
groups.
You would hope so.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
yet,
you would
and
think
yet
so.
It devolves constantly.
Yeah,
which is interesting in itself. I mean, my sense is that progressives are panicked in all sorts of ways, but particularly on this, like the Rotherham is like, I'm not the first to say this, it's the Chernobyl, right? It's this catastrophic disaster which highlights all of the problems with the regime, and it just, you can't make it go away. It just rumbles on and on.
The theme on that I found particularly interesting that's been emerging more recently as people are just relentless, insistently pursuing a more granular assessment of the truth, is this emergent theme that no, in fact, the parallels with the Epstein story are much richer than we thought, in the sense that this is the tip of the iceberg, and in fact what we're looking at is a network of criminality roughly analogous to the Sicilian mafia. And in fact, yeah, what we're looking at is organized crime, in which the girls were, in a sense, they were the Ferrero Rocher.
Right, you're thinking of Epstein,
and I'm also thinking of the grooming gangs.
Yes,
that pattern is present in both cases.
Yes,
and in this context, I think this is an incredibly challenging moment for left-wing feminists.
Yeah.
Because it, in a sense, two halves of your truth are coming inexorably apart in a way which is genuinely painful. I think.
Absolutely.
And it's, I'm watching the bloodshed there. And I'm watching radical feminists break in both directions in a way, which is really interesting.
And I'm seeing, I mean, this is why I recall the trans thing. I'm seeing radical feminists use exactly the same rhetorical strategies to try and avoid facing up to the truth as was used against them, 10 years ago.
That's really extraordinary. Fascinating, really extraordinary.
Yeah, just quibbling about statistics, quibbling about definitions, just playing games rather than being like, come on.
Yeah. I mean, it seems, So, I mean, if you were to speculate, how do you think this will cash out? I mean, is there anything we can learn from the way Turfism cashed out or has cashed so far about geotopia?
There was eventually a respectability cascade.
Yeah.
With Turfism. And the people who had previously condemned Julie Bindle stopped condemning Julie Bindle and never apologised. That was pretty much
nobody
what
ever
happened.
Said they were sorry.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess we can expect roughly the same thing to happen. Except I think actually this is going to be much more serious and much worse as a conflict.
Yeah, yeah. How do you think that's going to affect the equally ambivalent relationship between Christianity and feminism? This is an argument which has been going on for centuries. So, I doubt we're going to solve it today. But I mean, you made the argument very powerfully. I thought you wrote a superb piece a while back on repaganization, where you explored how the enabling cultural and moral foundations upon which feminism was even thinkable could not have come into being without the prior existence of Christianity. And even if feminism, even if some strands of later feminism later broke away and sort of rebelled against their moral ancestors in the form of, the Christian insistence on human dignity and on the equality of men and women in human dignity, and on chastity as being an obligation for both sexes rather than just for one, etc. and so on. And yet we find ourselves in a position now where the liberal feminists on one side reject Christian social teaching as being too reactionary. And there's a subset of right-wing Christians on the other side who reject the women's movement as being so in a sense it feels as though the breakup has been irreparable. And left these two sides radically polarized, and yet it seems to me that in fact there's, with the exception of you and perhaps me and a small group of indomitable Catholic feminists who insist that in fact these two things really have something in common with one another. Everybody else is sort of yelling at each other from the same kind of binary, like the boys and the girls at a disco. Nobody wants to talk to each other.
Yeah. Well, I think it's certainly true that the fully blank slate view of feminism, the widgets view, I don't think you can really. I mean, that's difficult to sustain full stop, because it so often encounters reality in a way that's destabilizing. But I think that's also very difficult to square with Christianity, not least because, Genesis has a fair bit to say about men and women being different from one another. I mean, they're just the foundational ideas are incompatible.
It's very difficult to do Christianity without any account of teleology as well, which is really what's going on in that blank slateist.
Yeah.
It says that we can be people without teleology, which seems, it seems odd to me, but it's genuinely held.
Yeah. I think that something that we haven't even talked about yet is the the effect of fertility on how that's and on how society is changing and is likely to change based on differential fertility rates.
But no, let's dig into that now, because this is the subject of your next book, isn't it?
It is. So I was on this question of the conflict between Christians who are anti-feminist, and like, there's a very big difference between religious and non-religious people in terms of fertility, mm-hmm. a very big difference, and increasingly there's a partisan fertility gap as well, which didn't exist 50 years ago. But now Republicans have like a whole extra child, I want to say. I can't remember the exact numbers, but they have a lot more children than Democrats.
Is that mirrored in the UK as well?
No one, as far as I know, has really broken it down. Maybe
the sample size isn't big enough.
Well, you could do it. It's just that the availability of the granular data is quite difficult. I mean, I can tell you that like Brighton has the lowest fertility rates in the country. Like, make of that what you will. But I would not be at all surprised if that also is true in other parts of the world. I think the Financial Times actually looked into the numbers and found this was consistent across the West, the partisan fertility gap and the religious fertility gap. I'm not entirely sure to what extent those are the same thing. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the people who hold to the most radical progressive views and atheistic views are not reproducing themselves.
They're busy deleting themselves from the gene pool.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily spell the end of the ideology, because they might succeed in converting other people's children. But religiosity, and to some extent, because one's political attitudes are based in large part on personality and other things like conscientiousness, open to experience, etc. And those things are heritable. So we should expect the people who are having children right now to produce people who are more ideologically like themselves in the next generation and the generation after that. And actually, the numbers can be quite stunning. Like, the difference between having a TFR, a total fertility rate of like 0.7, which I would guess is probably what we're looking at in terms of like secular progressives in the West, and having a TFR of 2 is enormous.
Yep.
Yeah, in terms of two generations hence.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. These are exponential effects. And so I feel like I almost feel like progressive ideas are not really, even though, as we discussed at the very beginning, I'll always feel like they're looking over my shoulder, they're on the way out, probably. And actually the big contest is going to be within conservative religious spaces. And questions like questions that Catholic feminists
to be a Christian and also a feminist, for
yeah,
example.
That's going to be actually the really big question, I'd say, of the next century.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Because I mean, this has been increasing in salience as a struggle sort of internally to the right.
This might already be why we're seeing rises in homophobia in Western societies.
Could be, although others have conjectured that's also related to. To birth rates and also to migration.
Yes, in the sense that's what I meant by demographics.
Inward migration from.
Yes,
thesis about. But before we get on to, and perhaps we shouldn't just get with my really radioactive thesis. But I want to talk about your much less radioactive, but also incredibly unpopular thesis on why this is happening.
Oh, my mortality salience.
Yes, I want to.
All right, and I'll tell the story.
Because everyone hates hearing about this.
Gets so mad. Everyone in the comments will be saying, "No, actually, it's because of my personal political hobby horse." That's actually definitely
hobby
the explanation.
Is the sole cause.
So when I first started writing this book, I'm writing this book about birth rate. The title originally was The Case for Having Kids. The working title now in my mind is The Future Belongs to Those Who Show Up. I'm more interested actually in how I think this is going to change the world, what predictions we might be able to plausibly make about how the world is going to change in the coming decades and century-ish, than in necessarily trying to persuade.
Pandas are notoriously difficult to persuade to get it on.
Yeah. I mean, having said that, I often get, and I'm so gratified always to get them, I get emails from women saying, and I know you do as well, saying, "I decided to have a baby partly because I read you or I listened to you and I was on the fence and then I thought, no, actually motherhood is a good thing." So we have these small ripples, these small beautiful ripples. But in general, I think trying to just tell people to have more children is not really a goer.
Showing people charts and graphs doesn't do anything.
No, indeed. Indeed.
Imagine deciding to get it on just because you looked at the graph, the line was going in the wrong direction.
I mean, certainly doing it for like the sake of the nation. I think that people ought to realise that there is no welfare state waiting for them when they're old.
Although, actually, in the 19th century, at the height of maternalism, which was the social cultural movement which spawned the anti-suffragists, but also spawned the church ladies who then became the welfare state.
Yeah, angel of the house kind of era.
It was explicitly... It was a familiar trope that having children for the sake of the race was a noble, honourable, and proper thing for all women to do.
Should we try putting that on a poster, Mary? See how it goes.
But this is this is to be clear. I'm not. This is not an argument which I am making.
But it is a persistent idea.
This was a completely normal thing to say.
Yes.
For 19th century church ladies
in Australia during the populate or perish period,
and they would have used that phrase. This is not my phrase. This is a phrase
for
that
race,
you see repeatedly,
yeah.
For the good of the race.
Yes, yes.
And it's astonishing, actually, when you think about how radically the discourse has come full 180,
yeah,
from the way it was completely normal to talk,
yes,
in the 19th century. And, you know, for better or for worse, and, you know, there are pros and cons of, yeah.
Sure, but our era is the outlier.
Our era is the
in
outlier,
general.
Yeah.
The line in Australia is... have one for mum, one for dad, one for Australia, to encourage people to have three children.
When did people abandon that?
I would guess the 1970s. I don't know when exactly that slogan was in in train, but probably about the same time that the White Australia policy was abandoned. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. So my thesis for the book, I started off thinking my political hobby horse surely is what explains why people aren't having children. And surely, you know, that it must be to do with, you know, lacking people not valuing motherhood enough and all the various economic trends that we've discussed, you know, not being conducive to childbearing and so on. The problem with trying to explain why fertility is falling everywhere is that it's happening everywhere. And it's even happening in places like sub-Saharan Africa. They still have high birth rates, but they're falling fast. And they're probably actually lower than a lot of countries make out. There are incentives to inflate births in some of these countries. But any explanation for why this is happening has to be able to account for everywhere from Japan to Iran to Chile to, you know, and trying to blame any particular thing, like trying to blame liberalism or feminism or anything, that just doesn't work. You might be able to blame, so like it's possible that like smartphones or something, like sometimes people say the internet is too distracting or gives scrambles people's status signals in a way that discourages fertility. The problem with that is that Britain and America and other really rich countries fell below the replacement threshold in the 70s,
mm-hmm,
so long before the internet came along.
That's right.
You might say that it's an accelerant, you know, it's possible. So I have been reading as much as I can around this topic and trying to work out what the puzzle is. The book primarily isn't about what the puzzle is, but it is still the big question that everyone wants to know, like what is causing this? And if you don't know what's causing it, you certainly can't rectify it. Which is why discovering the truth is important. I think that it's... So for most of human history, child mortality rates are very high. Our species norm for child mortality seems to be somewhere in the 30% to 40% kind of range. It goes up in certain periods, including in immediately post-industrial urban settings. But it is just high. It's high among hunter-gatherers as well. And this is one of these sort of horrifying things that no one ever wants to really think about too carefully because it's just so upsetting that you'd rather not think about it. And I think people are vaguely aware that this is true, but they sort of push it out of their minds. The Industrial Revolution led to a plummeting in child mortality rates, down from a third-ish to less than 1%, even in very poor parts of the world have remarkably low child mortality rates by historical standards because they have access to Western medical tech and sanitation and so on, which were all innovations that came out of Industrial Revolution that began in Britain. So really Britain, you know, gave the world this phenomenon for good and ill. But child mortality is like the great good that's come out. You know, the fact that people can expect their children to survive to adulthood is like it's the one thing about modernity which no one wants to lose. It's the most valuable thing about modernity. Mm-hmm. We can hate the internet, we can hate air travel, all of these things, but this is like, no one wants to let go of this.
I like the internet.
I like air travel as well. Anyway, I actually love modernity. Anyway.
I hate airports though.
Anyway. I fear that we know that what happened when child mortality initially fell from about 1800 was that the countries in which it fell initially saw massive booms in population because their fertility rates remained high. So in Britain, for instance, there was this enormous population explosion in the 19th century and a lot of people went overseas. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Anglo diaspora remains one of the largest ethnic groups in the world, because these people went to populate America and Canada and Australia and everywhere else. And it's because they had very high fertility rates and very low child mortality rates and they were able to just explode, okay? But after a while, fertility rates drop. After mortality rates have dropped, it takes maybe a couple of generations. It's fairly gradual. It's also somewhat mimetic. Mm-hmm. So people respond to what other people are doing around them. So if other people are having lots of kids, you're more likely to. If other people are having fewer kids, you're more likely to. Because obviously almost no one is looking at the charts on child mortality and being like, what are the chances that my children are going to survive childhood? People make these decisions based on social settings. And it seems that people cotton on to the fact that, it seems that in the ancestral environment, when we have very high child mortality, people have a natural instinct towards wanting to have more children with the expectation that quite a large number of them are going to die. And the standard for hunter-gatherer women is to have four children and two of them survive to adulthood. And that's just been true for almost all of human history up until 5 minutes ago, really. It seems that that instinct to have children is subdued in conditions of very low child mortality. And you see this happening really consistently everywhere. You have child mortality plummets. There's a lag. Lag gap does vary a bit, but there's a lag. And then fertility goes down as well. But fertility doesn't just go down to 2.1. Fertility keeps going down. And now it goes down to, in places like South Korea, it's down at 0.7, those kind of numbers, like really low. And there's other pieces of evidence to indicate this link as well. Like if couples have a child who dies, they have a very strong urge to have another child, try to have another child soon afterwards. If people know children, there's been some interesting studies on like going to funerals and how many funerals you go to. Does that affect how much you want to have a child? This is flimsier but interesting. There is also some research showing that if you remind people of death in a research setting, they say they want to have more children, and words relating to children spring more easily to mind than if they haven't been primed with mortality salience. There's lots of experimental data which I lay out in the book. The unfortunate fact, though, is basically this. In conditions of very low child mortality, a lot of people seem to lose desire to reproduce. And when they also have access to contraception, which makes it very easy for them to still have sex but not to reproduce, that's what happens. And I'm guessing that this is where we get speculative. I'm guessing that what could happen was, so I think there are two models that we might see emerge from this. One is the cyclical model, the Spengler model. Mm-hmm. So civilization contracts, there's population decline.
Chaos emerges and mortality.
Fall of Rome, exactly. And then we have a dark age, child mortality rises again, and people revert to the human norm. Another possibility is more like a J curve, where the people right now who for some reason are resistant to this and who for some reason still want to have, we both know people who have big families, despite the fact that they're living in conditions where that's very unusual. The people who are still having 4, 5, 6, 7 children, there's something about them, something genetic, something cultural, both, which preserves a desire to have children in a time when nobody else is really doing so.
So the open question for those of us who like airports and the internet is whether that's going to be enough people to keep all of that ticking over, or whether that's more is a sufficiently systemic exercise requires enough of us to be involved and capable that is not in fact workable.
Yeah. I mean, Elon's working very hard, you know, all on his lonesome to try and have his own progeny reproduce modernity indefinitely. He's not the norm, obviously, among people who are highly fertile at the moment.
Given all of this and the several possible apocalypses that we've just arrived at,
people get mad about this. Yes,
no. I'm not. I mean, it feels very plausible to me. Yeah. I mean, I'm generally sort of, you know, astride the bomb with my hat in one hand, like the guy at the end of a Doctor Strangelove.
I should say as well, I haven't originated this idea. Actually, if you go back and look at the demographic literature from the latter half of the 20th century, people completely knew this already. They knew that there
it's
was
already
very
there.
Strong
it's just that nobody wants to know because everyone's got their hobby horse.
Yes, and also that this was at the period of the population bomb being a source of anxiety. Mm. So what you read demographers saying is actually, don't worry, it's safe for us to reduce child mortality in third world countries because actually it will inspire them to have fewer children.
Right.
So we can inoculate these babies without having to worry about population explosion. That's what academics were concerned with at the time.
Oh, wow.
But of course you can read that now from a completely different vantage point and reach different conclusions.
Oh,
but the link between the two phenomena, I think, is quite well established.
So given all of these apocalypses, what's your source of hope? When you think about the future and you think about your own kids and you think about our prospects for and the likely futures that you and I will be spending the rest of our lives living through, what gives you hope? What's your source of optimism?
Humanity has seen far, far worse than this. I mean, genuinely though, that like
a fairly qualified notion of optimism.
Well, no,
I mean it's true though.
I mean, certainly in terms of this is the only period as far as I'm aware, where the reason we've seen massive population contraction is because of people just failing to reproduce rather than war, famine, pestilence, etc. Mm. Like, if you're going to live through a period of population contraction, this is a very easy ride. You know, it really is. So the big question is whether modernity survives.
Yeah.
I'm rooting for modernity in the end. Like for all of the problems with
I like the internet and I really like my washing machines.
And so, I really like C-sections and antibiotics. Okay, so I'm very much rooting for modernity. But even if modernity doesn't survive, everyone that we are descended from lived good lives without modernity. Like lived lives which were much harder than ours and which contained a lot more grief and pain than ours. But you can't say that those lives aren't worth living just because, I mean, if you were to say that, then you would have to just obliterate all of human history up until minutes ago.
So your source of hope is in fact the human spirit and the human capacity for nobility, more or less regardless of circumstances.
Yeah. And so if the Spengler model is true, the cyclical model, we just, you know, return to a dark age and back again, like, well, it wouldn't be the first time, okay? So the J curve is maybe more frightening in a way, because the thing that frightens me is the possibility of us obliterating ourselves. And that's where modernity becomes a very difficult bet, because, of course, if we are going to obliterate ourselves, it will be through tech.
I'm cautiously optimistic on that front.
I mean, it comes down to Christian faith in the end. I asked Ross Douthat this question when we were talking about AI. And I said, do you think in the end that the superintelligence wiping us all out, like God wouldn't let that happen? Like it's just not going to be how. And he said, yeah, basically in the end, like I can't really think that that's going to happen because I don't think that's how God would end the story. And I think I agree with him.
That's a perfect note to wrap up on. I think I agree with him too.
Yeah,
I would like to think that's not how God will end the story.
Yeah,
and that's a beautiful place to pause. Thank you so much, Louise, for joining me. It's been wonderful, and thank you so much to you all for listening. This has been Socrates in the City, Socrates Dialogues. I hope you'll join us again next time. You might be thinking, that's not Eric Metaxas. My name's Mary Harrington. I'm a writer and a past contributor to Socrates in the City. I'm thrilled to be joining Socrates in the City as the first inaugural Socrates contributor. Throughout 2026, I'll be hosting many fascinating conversations on life, God, and other small topics. Be sure to subscribe to get notifications whenever a new episode from Eric or myself drops. And thank you for tuning in.